This is Christy Westfall, and this is Health Cetera Radio. Families across the United States breathed a long sigh of relief with the recent renewal of the Children's Health Insurance Program, commonly known as CHIP. While a victory, it remains a small one within the grander landscape of child health in the United States. The federal government typically does not allocate much towards children's health. And this is true of both Republican and Democratic administrations. This sends a message from the top down that child health, not a priority in the United States. Joining Health Cetera today is Dr. Dowell Myers, USC professor, researcher, demographer, and award-winning author, who's here to tell us a little bit about the importance of children in America. You may have read his 2007 book, Immigrants and Boomers, Forging a New Social Contract for the Future of America. I think that forging these logical links with demographics and public policy may be one of his superpowers. And now, he's going to share some of his super insights at the intersection of children, aging, and the future productivity of our nation. So in this report, welcome, Dr. Myers.
Well, thank you.
So yes, this exciting report, The New Importance of Children in America, it came out in October, and what kind of prompted you to start this research?
Boy, you know, it's been something I've been working on in the background for quite a long time, you know, I study the biggest trends in America and how they're changing, and there's a number of them, and the one that kept getting glossed over turns out to be the most important is the children trend, because that's the future of America.
So how do you connect children to aging Americans? They seem at opposite ends of the lifespan spectrum, yet you've done it.
Well, they are the opposite strands, but they are part of the same families. Every family has children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren in the family. And what people don't always realize is that they're dependent on other people's children too. So that, you know, it's not rocket science. You know, the future is really uncertain, but one thing we know for sure, the kids will grow up.
That's true.
That is like a really important fact, because in our democracy, there's a lot of disagreement on, you know, global warming or you name it. But you can't disagree about children growing up. And so I think they're important both demographically and politically.
So the five-year-olds of today may be experiencing significantly different challenges than maybe when you or I were 5 years old. Can you speak to some of the demographic trends that you have seen that are changing from maybe back when we were five to five-year-olds now?
Well, a lot of our cultural and political beliefs about children are really rooted in the baby boom generation. When they were 5 years old, they just flooded everything. I mean, I was in portable, you know, classroom units. We just overflowed all the schools, and that we were swimming in kids, basically. And that created an attitude, I think, that we have more than enough kids. We have too many kids, and kids are pretty darn expensive. So who needs more kids? And while we weren't paying attention, that all changed. The birth rate really fell dramatically. The number of potential mothers also decreased. So fewer potential mothers and lower birth rate means a lot fewer kids. And then meanwhile, the baby boomers themselves, they got older. It's not, you know, not a big surprise, but although we try to resist, you know, admitting that when we look in the mirror each day. But over decades, it does add up. And basically, the boomers are now crossing age 65 and entering their Medicare years and retirement years. And the kids who are coming along in fewer number, they're the future workers who are going to support the older people now as the older people amass bigger and bigger numbers. And that's the most dramatic change, is the growth in seniors. And so the kids aren't really shrinking that much in total, a little bit, but the seniors who are being supported are doubling in number. And we don't know how to make that work exactly, because our entitlement programs are kind of rest on the idea that each generation will support the one ahead of them. But when the one ahead of them is so much larger, it really puts a lot of strain on the younger people. You know, the younger people can do it, but they have to really be fortified to maximum productivity if they're going to be able to carry the load.
So what less children might mean for the aging population is less workers to contribute to Social Security or Medicare. It might mean less caregivers to help care for them as they age. And as you said, if we aren't thinking about how we can maximize the capacity and the help of those children now, it may have serious implications for when we get old.
Yeah, it definitely, if you're gonna try to accomplish more with fewer, you have to make sure that all of your children then have really high quality preparation. That's the only way you can make it work with fewer.
And so what are some of the things that you think are some of these unique, I guess, challenges for children? In your report, I remember reading about income support, education, and healthcare is kind of being like a big triad for ways that we can provide additional supports for children. What are your thoughts on that?
The thing about kids is that the science has really been improving dramatically in the last decade, so that we know a lot more now about how the productivity of young adults is affected by their conditions when they were children 20 years earlier. We just didn't have the science on that until recently. And now all across the board, we find things that it starts from like before the children are even born, when the mothers are just pregnant. If the mothers grow up in an area in the world where there's famine or there's war, the stress of that actually affects the kids in utero and will then show up as some problem for them later on as adults. We never knew that before. So it starts with nutrition of the kids at a very young age, nutrition of the mothers, and then the kid, and then in the earliest possible language skills as they develop, you know, and the big gaps open up by age two, between the advantaged kids and the disadvantaged kids. It happens very, very quickly. And then the deficits accumulate as the kids grow older. So the agreement now among the scientists is that you get the biggest return on your investment by helping the youngest kids, because then the advantages then accumulate over time, as opposed to disadvantages accumulating. And you can bring these kids up to speed more cheaply if you target them at age 2 and 4 in kindergarten than if you try to wait until they're, you know, high schoolers and you want to then get them ready for college and, you know, they're so far behind at that point, it's very difficult. So that's been the big finding, I think, is just that it's a lifelong process and you need to invest over that. And then you get back a return that's 6, 8, 10 times of what the costs were initially to invest in the children's programs. And that return comes in a form of higher earnings that the children are capable of earning, and higher taxes that they're likely to make based on their higher earnings. All kinds of measures of productivity are expanded dramatically. So with fewer kids, we need to have them get an earlier start in life on a trajectory that's going to carry them to be the maximum producers and most responsible citizens they can possibly be when they're age 25 or 40.
I think what you're saying, too, really speaks to the life course health development theory through the Maternal Child Health Bureau as well. I mean, just knowing that we have the evidence and the science to support that, I mean, these critical periods in early childhood really do have huge impact across the life course for health and wellness. So the science is important, the evidence is important, and as I understand in your report, you have an index that you've used and created to kind of highlight, again, this important changing trend with aging adults, children, and their productivity. Can you tell me about that?
Well, the index is really simple. It's just based on what will be the ratio of seniors to working age when these children grow up. And the growth in that ratio is really alarming, what's happening. So the senior ratio is people age 65 and older divided by working age, which I measured here at age 25 to 64. And that was pretty constant from 1970 to 2000 at about 24 seniors per 100 working age, constant. Anything that's constant is invisible, it's taken for granted, nobody's even aware of it. But when the first baby boomers cross age 65, which is in 2011, and they're started across that line now, this ratio skyrockets. It goes up to 45, from 24 to 45 by 2030. So in the next 12 years, that ratio is up there at 45, which means there's a way more of a weight of seniors who deserve all of their entitlement, you know, benefits. They deserve all that, but it's got to be paid for by working age people, and it's out of balance now. And so I use that as a way of constructing an index of children's importance. And so kids who were born earlier weren't as important as kids who were born now and are in school now, because the ones now are destined to carry this much bigger weight on their shoulders than were those who in the years of the numerous baby boomers, when kids, I mean, every kid's precious, but economically they weren't as important then as they are now. And the ratio doubles, literally doubles now. So every kid is twice as important now as kids formerly were. And if they're twice as important, that suggests to me you should maybe double down your investment on kids to get them twice as prepared for the load they're going to have to carry. That's what we expect of them as they grow into adults.
So you also teach at the University of Southern California in the Saul Price School of Public Policy. So a public policy question. So how can you tie this data that you have, this evidence in supporting children, to it's been hard to kind of get the advocacy framework and, oh, support children, you know, into this is not a new argument, but I think that your research here presents a different spin on a problem that isn't an old problem, but a problem that nevertheless is still so vital to the health and productivity of our country. So why do you think traditionally it's been so difficult to change that frame, I guess? And how has times changed from when these policies originally were made to now?
I think originally there was a sense of big disparities and we should really help kids. But we had so many kids, it was very expensive to do that. And we played favorites. We couldn't afford to support all the kids, so some kids got supported more than others. And what's changed is that now we have an urgent crisis of not enough kids, and where we need to adjust to the soaring numbers of seniors in preparing kids for their duties as adults. That's a new emergency that wasn't there before. And I think that's what is changing things. The kids themselves have always been deserving all along, but now it's a crisis of all hands on deck. We need to get everybody ready to go. And there's nobody, we can't play favorites. We need everybody to be prepared. That's really the big change. I think some people still think about it as charity for children, and that would be nice for the children, but we can't afford it. But that's a very outdated view now. It's no longer charity. It's essential. It's an emergency.
I'd also like to tie this into immigration as well. You have some expertise in that area. And there's been a lot of, talk and controversy on immigrants in the United States right now. But immigrants have actually traditionally provided a lot of support to this country. And how does immigration impact children, aging, and everything in between?
I think immigrants are tied up with the attitudes about children. More and more of the children are children of that are not white. They're children of color. They're black, Latino, Asian, or some other combination of races and ethnicities. And that's sort of been frowned upon by some people many people who don't want to see racial change in America. And then they blame immigrants for bringing the racial change. And so that's a narrative of discomfort with changing racial identity. Whites are not going extinct. The absolute number of whites is still growing. It's just that there's more of the younger generation that's contributed from children of color. And so there was a time in California, like in the 90s, when we thought that the public thought that there were too many kids being brought by Mexican immigrants and they were expensive and we didn't want to pay for these kids that Mexicans had. That was an attitude. But that's really changed now that we realize that we don't have enough children. You need, 2.1 babies for every woman to sort of have replacement level to break even. And, California's down at 1.6 children per woman. And there's nobody having too many kids. Even the Mexican American mothers or all Latinas are only having 2.1 children per woman as it is. So they're breaking even, and everybody else is way below break even. So as it turns out, then, is that we have not enough kids in America today, and a quarter of the kids we do have one or more immigrant parent. So the immigrants are helping to shore up our shortage. Without the immigrants, then we would really be in a deep, deep hole with not enough kids. In California, it's as high as 50% of all children have an immigrant parent. But we're very thankful for those kids because we don't have enough kids. That's what's different today. The shortage of kids must change the priority we place on children. When you have a shortage, you can't take them for granted. They're scarce. They're valuable, more valuable. And we're grateful for every kid we can get. And we just need to cultivate these human resources so they can be the best workers and taxpayers they can possibly be. Ultimately, you know, one thing we worry about in California, especially, is we all live in these million-dollar houses, we think. 60% of all the homes are owned by baby boomers or people older. They're going to be selling their houses. And one of the questions I've been researching is, well, who's going to buy their house? And, you know, what kind of price are they going to pay for that house? It turns out it's going to be some kid. Some kid's going to grow up and be the buyer of that house. And the more educated the kid is, the more they can pay for the house. So when I do my arithmetic, I know who I want to have come knocking on my door to buy my house. I want to be the kid I invested in and not the kid that I shunted aside and, you know, he's a high school dropout. He's going to, what's he going to pay me for my? No, it's not possible. I need to have somebody who's a very productive kid who's grown up because I invested in him at a young age. And now when I sell my house, cash in my retirement assets, not right this year, but, you know, 10 years from now, I know that's what I want. And so it's a payback. We definitely get all the money back, but it comes back in the future because we made wise decisions in the present about the most obvious things. The obvious things being, here the kids are, there's not enough of them, but the kids will grow up, and they're the ones going to be our future workers, taxpayers, and home buyers. And I want them to be the very best they can be so that we, can, as a society, can flourish and prosper over the next decade or two the most that we can possibly flourish. It all depends on the kids and our investments today.
So for those of us that don't have the power of a policy position or, you know, we're not lawmakers, how can we help support this evidence and you know, provide support to the so what of this increasingly important problem?
Well, you know, it's interesting that, you know, we talk about policymaking and fact-finding and all that stuff, and so much the way it's going in America today is that we make policy based on stories, based on narratives of what is happening, what's good, what's bad, and how it all pans out. It's not made so much based on numbers. We dismiss those as you know, false facts or irrelevant or whatever, alternative facts, you know, but we really go with the story. And I think the story, the solution for the average citizen is to figure out what's the story, get behind the story, and tell the story. And the story is, we don't have enough kids. We're grateful for the kids we have. If we invest in the kids today, they will pay us back richly in the future. And we need to help every kid be the very best they can be, because we don't have enough. And we're grateful for these kids. We don't want to kick them aside. We really want them to be the best because that will help us all.
Well, thank you so much for joining the show, Dr. Myers. Thank you for sharing your insightful research. I think this is an important message for America to hear. Children represent less than 9% of the federal, you know, health spending budget. They represent 100% of our future. The new importance of children presents evidence that the disproportionate trends in the aging adult population and decrease in supply of children hold profound economic and ethical implications. For more information on this, you can check out childrenshospital.org and make sure to type in the new importance of children. You can Google it. Additionally, you can also go to the University of Southern California, USC website, and check out Dr. Dal Myers and the USC Saul Price School of Public Policy. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of HealthCetera as we delve into the new importance of children with Dr. Dal Myers. This segment was produced by Christy Westfall.